Welcome to the Compliance Perspectives Podcast. I'm Adam Turtletail from the Society of Corporate Compliance and Ethics and Healthcare Compliance Association. Joining us today from Dubai is Theo Bekele, Cynthia Kumalo, who is a longtime compliance veteran, and we're going to be talking today about vetting third parties. First of all, Cynthia, thank you for taking the time to talk to us today, or where you are tonight.
Hi, Adam. Thank you for having me.
Our pleasure. Now, when looking to work with a third party, what do you find is the best way from a compliance perspective to initially scope out the requirements? Do you do that with the business team when developing the RFP? And if not, how do you ensure that compliance gets an adequate say in the process?
I think it's very important to remember that compliance is an enabler for the business to enhance its functions. So it's always going to start from a perspective of engaging what the business requirements initially are. So what is it that we internally are missed off in terms of our capacity, and what is it that we believe would be required from a third-party supplier, and how do we ensure that that particular supplier does have the technical capabilities as well as the legislative parameters to execute whatever said scope of work. So it's definitely an approach that is highly consultative with the business units, and we come in as analysts of the actual execution of the development of the scope of work for legislative and policy related requirements, and we do have certain checks and balances that we run through with the team internally, as well as just helping the team to assess some of the third party suppliers within the range of the suppliers that might be in our database. But yeah, I would say the critical thing is to understand what is it that we are we've defined as our risk appetite, what are our parameters of operations, what is the critical scope of need, and what is it that we can do internally to ascertain and assess the capabilities of the service provider so that we are at all points capable of monitoring and evaluating the performance of said provider.
Now, when it comes to monitoring the performance and the safety of working with that provider, you know, it all starts with the due diligence process. Now, when conducting due diligence, what have you found are the key things to look for?
Well, it's always the standard traditional things, really, Adam. You know, when you look at the standing in terms of legislative policy, the portfolio of the service provider, the desktop research that you would do as far as the performance of that particular provider, whether it's the shareholders or the ownership, what is their media presence looking like? I think the benefit of technology that is brought forth is the ability to gather data and centralize a lot of data that we previously didn't have traditionally. So now we have a pool of information that we can drag from different systems of our GRC systems to analyze the credibilities. You know, you look at things like political standing, you look at things like, you know, the makeup of the state shareholders or ownership and things like that within a click of a button. So that makes it a little bit easier. And another thing that one would actually throw in there is the presence, the geographical presence of other analysts on the ground that might be able to basically assess things that one would not be able to do via desktop and things like that. But yeah, I would say that looking at technology and using things like artificial intelligence, data mining and things like that have really come in handy in the advent of the growth of the field of compliance.
It's remarkable all the innovations that are out there and how they can best be used. Now, what are some of the things that have you found may seem important to look at, but tend in practice to be less so?
Well, I think that that's a very difficult question to answer, because in every project, there are different requirements and there are always known unknowns and unknown unknowns. So for one to actually have come to a conclusion of what is not paramount would be a little bit ill-advised. So it's always a retrospective component wherein when you're closing off a project, you look back and you say, well, we in future may not need to exercise as much effort in that area or in that other area, depending on the outcome of the risks and so forth. But to say there's a standard or an area in which I can point out and say, let's pay less attention to would be ill-advised.
Well, it's always better, I guess, to look more than less. And you know, when it comes to doing due diligence, it's not easy though to get all the information you want from the vendor. I mean, getting to more is harder, and getting to even the basics can be difficult. But it's also when you're doing that initial due diligence, the point where you have the most leverage to get the data you need. What's the best way you found to set up the relationships so that you'll have effective audit rights for the long term as well? Because you know, the risk does remain and things can change.
Well, I think that's a very interesting question, and it is one of the most challenging areas as far as trying to make sure that you stay in the good books or whoever it is. So I think the first thing is I found to be useful is the development of authentic relationships. I think traditionally there's been a misconception of compliance being the police officers of entities and the guys that are trying to catch people doing something wrong. So changing that perspective internally is something that I have always driven towards, making compliance a very friendly department wherein everybody feels safe to communicate. That permeates externally. So you find that the front end or the team that's responsible of engaging with our external parties actually does send a positive message of who we are as a compliance team. And that creates a good standing in terms of establishing initial relationships with third parties, with external organizations. And I mean, obviously the fact that we do in most cases have shared interests as far as maintaining clean sheets, reputational management, avoiding any legislative or policy issues as organizations. So we do leverage on the fact that we do have those shared interests. We use our front end of client facing teams to basically handle holders, and we piggyback off of their relationships. But more importantly, we are very transparent. I mean, in my approach, I've always been very transparent in how I engage with external parties in terms of what is the objective of the assessment and what is the intended use of this particular information. That does eventually help ease tensions and makes people more open in terms of creating long-term relationships when it comes to audits and things like that.
Well, and you raise a good issue there in that for the entity that you're evaluating, they're obviously concerned not just about getting the business, but also what's going to happen with all that information you're getting and establish that you're getting from them, and establishing that trust that you're collecting it for the right reasons and will safeguard it can make an enormous difference. Now, on an ongoing basis, what should compliance teams be auditing and monitoring for to ensure that the risks are adequately assessed and any that come up are mitigated?
I think the first thing is the alignment to the scope of work. We have read in many cases wherein certain entities have been found wanting for having closed off projects and paid certain third party suppliers, but there isn't evidence to suggest that work was done, for instance. So I think the ongoing is setting up a proper compliance universe that has processes and systems for checks and balances to assess the project as it goes, and to assign proper responsibilities to whoever, whether it's the technical team internally and externally, to effectively gather data to support the performance of the project and to ensure that there is enough oversight. So escalation points, processes of rights of change management processes and systems, I think that plays a critical role in ensuring that we adhere to whatever scope of work has been set. And I think that's where the money actually lies. And I think after that, the ideas of essential data management is critical to the continual monitoring and evaluation of said projects. And I don't know, I think for me, those are usually the go-to areas, and then the rest sort of like falls in line after that's been done well.
And hopefully everything will both fall in line and stay in line. Before we go, I just want to go off topic. You know, you used a great phrase twice in this call. We talked about checks and balances. And what's interesting to me is in many ways, it really is the way compliance functions, but it's a rarely used phrase. And I don't think it should be. Have you used that like with the business units as a good way for helping them understand really what the role of compliance is? Do they respond to that?
I like the fact that you've actually caught me on that term, and I agree with you. I think it's one of those in terms that we tend to use within industry professionals. But when we are talking to our clients, we do put the communication in a manner that exposes the objective. So we would like to understand why this is happening, this is the reason why, and this helps the business XYZ. So we always translate this communication to be more business savvy, to actually indicate the interest of the business objectives and to preserve their interest, as opposed to it being a check and a balance type of situation. So yeah, kudos on actually pointing that out.
Well, thank you. And thanks for sharing, both that term and also all this insights into effective third-party management. Well, Cynthia, again, thank you for spending time with us and sharing these insights. I want to thank all of you for taking the time to listen. I'm Adam Turtletaub from SCCE and HCCA. I hope we're able to expand your compliance perspective.